From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capital Notes podcast for the week of November 13th.
This is our fall edition.
Yeah, no, right. We're just doing one a season now. I'm John Myers from KQED. That's Anthony York, the editor of Capital Weekly. And
we're back.
Welcome back. Or no, welcome back to me. Or welcome back, audience, for more fun and excitement on these podcasts. Thank you. If you're listening, thank you for finding the podcast again. We've been on hiatus because Anthony didn't want to do that anymore. It was a little contract dispute, and he walked off the job.
I like to summer in Bermuda, and you know they don't have podcasts.
Well, we wouldn't meet his demands for his high salary for the podcast.
It's not true. John Myers had a baby. Don't let him tell you different.
I had one, which would have been a medical feat. My wife and I had...
I've seen Junior. I know what happens.
My wife and I had a son 6.5 weeks ago,
Yay.
Jonah. So he's home, probably crying his head off right now. Maybe he'll soothe him with the podcast and the iPod in his room. What do you think?
His master's voice.
No, just yours.
Right.
You could describe the water negotiations to him.
Segue.
Look,
you haven't lost it.
I haven't lost it. I'm not sure I ever had it.
Exactly.
We won't go backwards too far into time because that's just no fun. We'll just pick up as though we were never gone. But we could start a little bit talking about that lovely subject known as water issues in California, which I thankfully missed the big ugly ending to that. Anthony,
it was a little convoluted.
You did all the work.
Exactly.
You were here until what time? What time did that end that morning, where the final water votes were taken?
Six. You know, your standard sunrise. You know, nothing out of the. It was early, right? Because the budget didn't end until almost.
But when you've
afternoon.
Seen this many sunrises in the Capitol building this year, I mean, that's a problem. But that's.
Yes,
so that's
it is
another
a problem.
Discussion, I suppose.
Yes.
So the governor has been slowly signing the different bills in the package, slowly signing them, like with his arm really slowly. The final bill in the package being signed on Thursday, the day we're recording this, out in the Delta, Twitchell Island,
where they love their water deal, don't they?
Yeah, they love it in the Delta. So what do you want to talk about the water deal? What do we make in the final analysis of that big morass of negotiations and behind-the-scenes politics and an $11 billion bond?
Right. And I think that's the real story is that it's not – this story isn't over. I mean, on the policy side, you're going to have all sorts of legal fights. I imagine there'll be all sorts of lawsuits. The governor – now, very clearly, the day after the water deal passed, he goes to Stockton and says – now we can build the peripheral canal, which is like,
right.
You know, I don't think he knew his audience.
And
there
the crickets,
real well.
You hear the crickets out there.
Exactly.
Silence.
Exactly. The canal is not very popular in Stockton.
He's also been trying to not call it a canal anymore, too.
It's conveyance.
He's working real hard on conveyance. He was at the Fresno Bee Ed Board the other day and saying you could build it underground. It
right,
may
the
not
tunnel.
Really be a
yeah,
the tunnel.
Tunnel.
Maybe
right.
It's not a canal anymore. But anyway,
yeah.
I digress.
No, but the big part of this, the $11 billion bond that you mentioned is going to be on the November 2010 ballot. At least that's the plan right now. We've seen the legislature move these things when the climate is not right. But
and the climate could be ugly, but we'll get to that. Sorry.
We'll get to that. But, you know, I mean, I think that that it was a much needed win psychologically for the legislature and the governor. This is a governor who, I think if you talk to folks around him, is increasingly focused on his legacy. He's had the misfortune of being in office during some of the worst financial troubles this state has ever known. And he's not happy about it. And I think he's very concerned about his image. He always has been. And this is no different. I think that this water deal now is going to be the centerpiece of his legacy. And I think that the governor is very committed to making sure that this thing gets enacted.
Let's talk about that for a second. Just you saying that makes me think all kinds of things. Because when you say the water deal would be the centerpiece of his legacy, that sounds just like what people used to think about AB 32, the global warming thing would be the centerpiece of his legacy.
Well,
and then, I mean,
right,
and then even he ran for office on the whole state's financial problems, which, you know, I mean, so I don't really know what my point is other than it's an evolving standard of what is the centerpiece. And maybe my reaction is somewhat of what you're getting at is that it always feels like we're looking for something else that's big enough to call the centerpiece.
Well, I think if you do sort of step back and look, I mean, obviously AB 32 and environmental protection is going to be central to how we think of Schwarzenegger. Although, you know, that's not going to play out for a long time. I mean, we're not going to see, you know, it remains to be seen what gets adopted, what the actual regulations are. I mean,
and
we
you
do
think
have
water
a plan
may play out sooner than that?
Well, I think that water, not necessarily, but I think water is the final piece in the sort of Pat Brown-esque infrastructure bonds. Arnold Schwarzenegger as builder.
Started in 2006 with that mammoth bond package.
There was a school bond, a transportation bond. There were four different bonds. This is the piece they couldn't get.
Yeah.
And I think that if you string those together, that will be a sort of Pat Brown-esque model that I think this is going to be the sales pitch from Team Schwarzenegger going forward.
Now let's talk about the bond though. $11.1 billion.
It smells like bacon in there all of a sudden. You just said that.
Theoretically, on the November 2010 ballot, big discussion earlier than that about should you put it all on one ballot.
Right.
And I guess what they decided to do, correct me if I'm wrong, I was in a fog with baby bottles, but it's all on one ballot, but the selling of the bonds would be staggered somehow. They wouldn't all be sold immediately.
Right.
And this is part of what the governor and his supporters have been pushing over the last few days as saying why it's unfair to say this is a huge addition to the debt service of the state, because bonds are borrowing. You have to pay it back. We've
right.
got a lot of debt service on the books as it is. And so I think that's part of the governor's new thing is like, well, we're not selling them all at once. So we're not going to add that several hundred million dollars of debt service immediately to the state budget. That's part of what I heard him say. But it's staggered somehow then, I guess,
You can only sell half in the first 5 years.
There you go.
That's up to half over the first 5 years. But still, I mean, if you sell all of that, that's, you know, $5.5 billion worth of bonds, the debt service on. I mean, you're still talking about several hundred million
right.
dollars. Even if it's not all at once, it's certainly over time.
That's part of the sales pitch. That's part of the political pushback. Framing,
right.
spinning, however now.
Well, and if you look at the bond itself, I mean, it's clear that whatever compromises people made on the policy side, the payoff came in the bond. I mean, there's just earmarked, you know, earmark after earmark, to use a Washingtonian phrase.
Christmas tree.
It really is. I mean, it's...
Do you know that one, podcast listeners, where you attach your own little trinkets to the tree? Anyway,
yeah, well, you know, or holiday bush.
Oh, sorry. That's right. Right.
Hello.
Sorry. Okay. Hello. For those who are not raised in the Christian faith, please go ahead.
Both
continue.
Of you. But point being, that's going to be. I think it's very possible we could see a coalition form against this bond that was very similar to the coalition that formed in May.
Against
Prop 1A. You had the far right or the anti-tax groups joining with public employee unions who worry about debt service gobbling up a larger portion of the state's general fund, which is how they get their funding. And
right.
so
means less money for the programs they care about.
Right. And so they came together in May to defeat Proposition 1A. And I wouldn't be surprised if you see something similar, a similar coalition come together in November.
And even before that, I mean, a lot of people were talking about this when I left. And so let's bring it back up. But the public's appetite for that, when they have been told the state is effectively in the toilet financially. And sticking
with the water metaphors.
Exactly. Yeah, but I don't want to go too far in that one because that's a whole different kind of podcast.
Yes.
But the state's really in financial trouble. They've been hearing that, and now they're going to hear, let's go borrow $11 billion plus the interest, so whatever the debt service will be, plus what the final total will be bigger than $11 billion.
Right.
So they're going to hear that. They're going to hear a huge discussion in November about the future of the state through the race for governor, and there will clearly be lots of discussions then about can the state afford this. And then I went back and looked about it. You talked about the 2006 infrastructure bonds. There was a bond in that package called a water bond,
right. Prop 84.
And I went back and that was
not put on by the legislature.
Fair enough. But the whole package was sold as a package.
Right.
And the governor certainly did that. So did Democratic leaders. And if you go back and you look at one of the campaign brochures, which I was doing just yesterday, because I kept thinking, what was in that bond? It was a lot of – it was other stuff, too. It was parks and wildlife
right.
stuff. But it continued to be sold as a protect our water supply kind of thing, which right. gets back to this notion of voters going, haven't we done this already?
Yeah.
Which has been part of the problem in recent elections, is that voters keep coming back and saying, I thought I did this. I thought I did this. I thought I did this. I thought I did this.
Right.
So it seems like that even before you have that possible coalition of opponents, you've got a fundamental problem of just presenting this to the public, given the finances and given what you've already been telling them.
Yeah, it's a tough sell, and I think you've got some natural constituencies that are already against the bond on both sides. You know, whether or not they think they've already done this in 2006, I don't know. I mean, I do think that you know, all the parties involved have underscored the sort of momentous and historic scope of this water agreement that really does differentiate it from Prop 84. Yes. But you know, I think your first point that, you know, voters have heard so much bad news about the economy, well, it's about to get a heck of a lot worse.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
the state budget too is going to get worse, right?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Is that, you know, we got some new numbers this week that are, I think, you know, before we get to November, we're going to have to survive January and June. And, you know, it's November is it's a long time away in the world of politics, certainly.
Yeah. And if anything, the bond thing, the only thing you can say about it's a full employment act for political consultants.
It's
going to be a huge campaign
yeah.
on both sides. So lots of good money for them.
Yep. Well, and the author of Proposition 84, Joe Caves, was the same guy who wrote this water bond deal. So there are some similarities there. And if you go back and read Prop 84 and who got some of the funding there and you look at this water bond, I mean, a lot of these conservancies and these groups, this is how they get their funding. They go back to voters every few years and the voters keep on giving.
All right. Well, let's switch gears and talk about the next thing that the governor has got on his plate, at least as far as us reporters are concerned. We're already continuing to pepper him and his aides with questions about it. And that is, who will he appoint as lieutenant governor? As you and I were clairvoyant.
Yes.
No, clairvoyant's not really the right word. We were
Our prognostication.
Nice, yes. Yeah, yeah. We were really good that John Garamendi was going to win.
We were really good that.
We were really good.
Yes.
We were really good in predicting that John Garamendi was going to win his seat in Congress. Boy, what a shocker.
We're more gooder at talking, though.
Yes, we are. I have an excuse. I haven't slept. I don't know what your excuse is.
I don't know.
So Garamendi took his seat in Congress this week, and now we have a vacancy in the office of lieutenant governor. It was this week, wasn't it? Oh, no.
He took it
at the end of last week.
Yeah.
Sorry, but hey,
it's okay.
Details. Who cares?
Okay.
Nobody's really.
It's in the same 7-day window.
Nobody's really paying attention to the nope. details in this podcast.
Podcast listeners don't have calendars.
They just believe everything we say.
Right.
So a vacancy in the office of lieutenant governor. Everybody wants to know who Arnold Schwarzenegger will appoint. Whatever the real short list is, who knows? He's kind of given us a 2-week time frame, as he said to the Fresno Bee folks this week, and his office says that's probably accurate. But he also is not in a tremendous hurry. He doesn't have to do it anytime soon. I mean, he's not under any requirement. If you don't know the process, the state constitution doesn't say he has to do it within a certain amount. Act frankly, doesn't
right.
say he
doesn't
has to do it
at all.
Yeah, he could just leave it vacant, which I think would be a great story in and to itself. Because he's never really thought the office amounted to much.
No.
But the process is as such as the governor gets to appoint and the legislature gets to knock down the appointment if they choose.
Either house.
Right. Yeah. Right. They don't have to vote to confirm.
Correct.
But they can. But if they don't vote to reject, then the person becomes lieutenant governor.
Right. And keep in mind, in the Senate, you have four candidates for lieutenant governor. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Sam Onestad, Jeff Denham.
Republicans.
And Alan Lowenthal and Dean
Flores, who are Democrats.
Right? Anyone in the Assembly running for Light Gov?
I think that's the Light Gov field at this point.
So there are some political issues there.
So there are a million names, it seems like, floating around.
Right.
So I don't know where to start. But what I will say, what I think is fascinating, is that there's only one Democrat name, really, that you hear floated around a lot. Right? Bob Hertzberg.
Right.
Former Speaker of the Assembly.
He's a Democrat, yeah.
Yeah. Former Speaker of the Assembly, friend of Arnold, stogie in hand, ready to hang out. And the governor's
California
made it clear.
California Forwarder.
Yeah, he's running California Forward now, the reform group that wants to change some things about government. You know, the governor has basically said that he wants someone who thinks like him or has the same agenda as him, though it's kind of hard to know exactly what that agenda is. And you know, the lieutenant governor doesn't have a huge role. It's largely ceremonial, though he sits on some important commissions, at least a few of which could come up that make real policy debates over the next year. There's this discussion of whether the person should be a caretaker and just not run for the office in 2010, which is a huge issue because, as you just said, you've got a field of candidates. You've got all these back politics about if you leave a vacancy in the legislature. I mean, I don't know.
And don't forget oil drilling, right?
Well, that's what I was going to say. That's one of the policy issues. The lieutenant governor sits on the State Lands Commission and could approve the Trancheon Ridge project off Santa Barbara County. But, okay, so you've got Hertzberg as a Democrat has been rumored.
Yes.
You've got Abel Maldonado, state senator from Santa Maria, has been rumored. As a matter of fact, the Contra Costa Times last week said they've been told
the
governor has picked him.
Right.
We'll see.
Right.
We've heard Tom Campbell, who's running for governor.
Dave Cogdell.
And Campbell, I should say, did not shoot down the idea that he would take it when he talked to one of my colleagues last week.
Right.
Dave Cogdell, state senator from Modesto, who announced his early retirement this week.
Mm-hmm.
Who
else is in the mix?
Yeah, who else is in the mix? Willie Brown, someone said, though I think that's kind of funny. So I guess that would be another Democrat, but I'm not sure that's a real Democrat.
I think we could start with those, take those one at a time.
Or take them one at a time or just figure out where do we – I mean, what do you think? I mean, I don't know.
I do think it's interesting that Cogdell – let's start with Dave Cogdell. Dave Cogdell was the Republican lead on water policy. The former Senate Republican leader was thrown out by his caucus in the middle of budget negotiations back in February.
9 months ago. Yeah.
For agreeing to a deal that included tax increases. And you know, I think Cogdell feels like now that the water piece is done, that he's done as well. And so the fact that he's resigned, that he's talked about wanting to go back and spend time with his family, and then that day, that very day, the governor, or the day before, the governor was at the Fresno Bee editorial board saying that Cogdell was on his short list.
But is there any chance, and I want to be very respectful to Senator Cogdell, this is no diss to him, but Senator Cogdell was sitting right next to him at the editorial board. Is there any chance that the governor said, oh, yeah, and Cogdell's on the list because he felt bad because Cogdell was sitting there?
Yeah, but I think
because Cogdell's not a name that had come up in a lot of chatter before that, was he?
No, but the fact that he sort of announced his retirement, I think, makes him more of an attractive candidate to other members of the Senate because he would be the sort of steward that would not run, presumably, for re-election.
Well, okay, go ahead.
The other piece of that is I get a sense among some folks that there's a lot of, and this ties into the Abel Maldonado thing, that there's that there is a lot of thought being put into how will you get a budget through both houses, because we're going to face a real tough vote or two coming up here next year, and you know, if you appoint Abel Maldonado, the Republican from Santa Maria, that's a seat that Democrats feel like they could win.
And that's where I was going to go. That's why the Maldonado one works for me, because that's a district that probably should be a Democratic district.
But the other interesting thing about that is if he appoints Maldonado, remember Sam Blakesley, the Assembly Republican leader, would run for that seat. And I imagine, you know, we'd have to step down as leader. There'd be a whole new power struggle in the Assembly again. So it's, again, something else to think about.
And the Democrats would have to find a strong candidate in that district. And I was down in that district last week in San Luis Obispo and talking to some folks. And I don't know that a strong Democrat has emerged out of that district so far. And that's a great question. If Blakesley decided that he would jump immediately to the Senate, that may not be then such a sure bet that the Dems would get that seat. And that's all budget politics, because you're two votes short of a two-thirds majority if you're a Democrat in the Senate right now. So you would only give Maldonado the light gov job if you really thought you were going to get something in return.
Well, and the other piece of this is the governor also last week appointed Senator John Benoit to the Riverside County Board of Supervisors, creating another Senate vacancy. And
that's a pretty strong Reap district, isn't it?
It is, but the folks that are running, you've got former Assemblyman Russ Bogue taking a look, current Assemblyman Bill Emerson, Assemblyman Brian Nastandi, and Assemblyman Jeff Miller. I think there's a sense a Republican's going to win that district, but there's a sense, certainly among the Democrats that I talk to in the legislature, that Emerson is a quote-unquote more reasonable Republican, that he's sort of a deal maker and a kind of person who, although he didn't vote for the budget last time around, he's the kind of person who, if push came to shove, would and could potentially be a 27th vote in the Senate. So I know that that Senate Democrats, I think quietly, to say they're supporting Emerson might be strong, but I think they're watching.
All right, but let's go back to light gov sweepstakes, though. Right. What would be the downside, then, of giving Denham the job as an appointee? Because Denham's district, who's a Republican, Jeff Denham, who's running for the job, is also one that was drawn for a Democrat.
Right.
And so maybe rather than the uncertainty of the Maldonado district, maybe you just appoint Denham.
Well,
I have no inside info. We're just parlor gaming.
Look, I think that if you're Dean Flores, do you want Jeff Denham, who's a senator from the Central Valley, running for lieutenant governor? Do you want Jeff Denham to get that appointment? I mean, then he gets lieutenant governor as his ballot designation. I think that Flores would push hard for the Senate to reject Denham. I mean, I think there would be some, and Sam Onestad as well. I mean, you've got
But Onestad doesn't get you anything. And
no, but I'm saying you've got a Republican, and Sam Onestad has his supporters in the Senate who are not supporting Denham, who would have an interest in blocking that nomination. I mean,
politics. I think it just becomes an issue of budget politics, though, and that's why I'm talking about it. And you know, and the reality too is that any Republican the governor appoints in this position, even if his ballot designation is lieutenant governor, is still going to have an uphill battle keeping that seat. This is a Democratic state by registration.
The
Democrats are going to have money. The Democrats are, you know, maybe favored to win the governor's race. My point is, you would agree, it's not a fait accompli that an appointed Republican would get to hold on to that seat.
So, no, but I think an appointed Republican would have a much stronger chance of holding on to that seat than say, Sam Onestad or Jeff Denham running, you know, cold and trying to spend the money to introduce themselves to voters. And ask your parents who Jeff Denham is and see if they can tell you.
Well, my parents live in North Carolina, so it's not going to
happen. My point exactly.
all right. Well, I don't know where else we'll go on it. I mean, there are other Democrats that are out there that a lot of people wonder would they run for lieutenant governor.
Fabian Nunez.
Well, let's go back to the person who dropped out of the governor's race, Gavin Newsom, the mayor of San Francisco. The rumor mill refused to die about Newsom and the lieutenant governor's job when he got out of the race for governor. And Newsom and all of his people denied it until they were blue in the face. And that's perfectly understandable. And we'll take him at his word. But there would be reasons that would seem to make sense for a Gavin Newsom to run for lieutenant governor. One of them would be that it would give him a statewide profile to run for governor afterward, you know, in a few years. If Jerry Brown runs and wins as governor, some people don't think he would run for a second term because of his age.
Because he'll be running for president.
Well, but because of his age, in which case, in which case, Gavin Newsom could be the next guy there. So I guess what I'm saying is I mean, who knows that the field of candidates as it sits now is even set for the lieutenant governor's race. I mean, there have got to be some Democrats who wonder if Dean Flores and Alan Lowenthal, no disrespect to
them. Well, and Janice Hahn.
Are high profile enough. Yeah. To carry against an appointed incumbent LG come November.
I mean, if I had to put money on a candidate right now, I'd say Janice Hahn is probably in a stronger position. Although she's not known to folks in Sacramento as much, she's, you know, the Hahn family is
vote
very
rich
well
Los
known.
Angeles.
And yeah, she's from Los Angeles. I mean, that sentence, she
is from
Los Angeles.
Right.
Those are two very important.
Woman from L.A.?
Yes,
did I pick that up? Okay.
Yes, yes.
I'm sharp like that.
And a Democrat and from a legendary Los Angeles political family.
Well, we're going to get a lot of time to talk about this.
Well, the lieutenant governor's race. Yeah. But on the Newsom thing, I mean, I think that for people who envision themselves as governor, who really, you know, who are, I mean, especially folks like Villaraigosa and Newsom, who are mayors of big cities and view themselves as important people and important jobs, lieutenant governor's rough. I mean, there's not a lot of people who, I won't say that, but there are certain kinds of politicians who I think have a hard time biding their time. You know, I mean, you look at the folks who are lieutenant governor, I mean, Gray Davis, John Garamendi, they're very different political creatures.
Well, Gray Davis is really the only person who parlayed it into governor in modern times. I don't know how far back I can go, but
no, Mike Curb. That's about all I got.
Anyway,
but point being that it's not necessarily a stepping stone to governor. True, and it's not a real glamorous job. It's like, you know, Benson. Remember the show Benson? Wasn't he the lieutenant governor?
But the job is what you make of it, though, right? I mean, you...
With your $1 million budget, right? Remember the governor slashed his the office's budget? It can be a bully pulpit, but I think that that the people who want to be governor... I mean, look at Steve Wesley, right? Here's a guy who was state controller, and this is a different down-ticket office, but Steve Wesley saw himself, I'm sure, as... You know, the natural progression from millionaire to governor to president, right? Isn't that the way it usually works in our society? So, I mean, imagine if Steve Wesley hadn't run in 2006, if he had been the guy who had been beating up Arnold Schwarzenegger over the last 4 years, over all the state worker furloughs and then he was the Democrat with experience and money, and now he could be a strong candidate for governor. I mean, imagine if he had waited, but. He didn't want to wait. And I think that there are certain politicians that are impatient about certain kinds of things and don't want to bide their time in jobs that they don't really want. I mean, I think Gavin Newsom takes some pleasure in being mayor of San Francisco. I'm not sure he would – I mean, you know, I'm not sure he would derive that same pleasure from lieutenant governor. I'm not sure he would wake up in the morning, look himself in the mirror and say – I'm so happy to be lieutenant governor.
Well, I think it's a great point. The only thing I'll say, and then we've got to wrap up with that part because we're getting long here, is that there are a lot of people who think Gavin Newsom needs some space from San Francisco if he's ever going to be governor, that San Francisco will be hung around his neck too much in the rest of the state. And the only way – and one of the great ways you could get rid of that is a job that gave you distance from San Francisco for a while with a statewide profile. But
well,
who knows?
I think he's thinking more U.S. Senate would provide that distance.
Well, then he needs to talk to Ms. Feinstein, who, by the way, we don't – even people still, keep saying, will Dianne Feinstein jump in the race for governor?
Willie Brown's pick. Apparently.
Apparently in the paper. All right. Before we wrap up, we've just got to say that the one guy who hasn't declared for governor, who everybody's watching, but, you know.
I'm not running, John. Yeah, I'm not running.
I think he said when the snow flies in the Sierra, and I hate to tell him, but it has already snowed a little bit in the Sierras.
Yeah, there was
so far.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago.
Jerry Brown. Mild a little story with Jerry Brown. We think mild, but who knows what will happen, where his official spokesperson, the Attorney General's office, had to resign this past week. After it had been revealed, he was recording conversations with reporters over the phone without their consent. Every crash here in the studio, was that like a – anyway.
Moving on.
Yeah, right. Was that
– it was a sound effect. We don't have the FM radio soundboard.
The Attorney General calling. Every reporter knows that in California, it's a two-party consent state, that both people on a phone conversation have to consent for recording to be legal.
This thing isn't being recorded, is it? Is
this thing on? Did I not tell you that?
Is this thing on?
Is it on? Is this on? Anyway, and so the Scott Gerber, the spokesman, resigned. Yes. Some people still think it's a story. Anthony doesn't think it is. Anyway.
It's bad form. It is bad form.
When you're this top law enforcement officer of the state and your spokesperson seems to be doing something that doesn't look like it jibes with the law.
What's more suggestive to me is what sort of work environment is there in the Attorney General's office where the spokesman feels like they need to record conversations to cover their own butts? Hmm. I mean, that was my immediate reaction. I mean, knowing nothing about what it's like to work in the Attorney General's office. That was kind of my thought.
And then the transcript of some of Brown's conversations
classic.
With people. Right, exactly.
Oh, they were hilarious.
Because the consumer watchdog people did a Public Records Act request and got all the documents. Right. So they got transcripts of Jerry Brown talking to the AP and some other folks. And
LA
it was
Times.
Just classic Jerry Brown. Yeah. I mean, I'll put a link on the blog if you haven't read some of the transcripts. But it is
make sure you have your own astronaut.
Yeah, it's classic Jerry Brown, and you know it really reminds a lot of people what they like and don't like about Jerry Brown.
Both of those things,
and
in one sentence,
and
sometimes.
Both of those are important issues as we look at the race for governor next year,
and next week,
and the rest
and
of
beyond.
Right, because we got to talk about that before the budget starts. We'll just kind of
when the snows fly in the Sierra.
Yes. He's imitating falling snow. Okay, that is way far enough for this first podcast. See, we had it all pent up in us after that long hiatus. For Anthony York from Capital Weekly, I'm John Myers from KQED. Thanks again for finding us after all these weeks. We'll see you next time.